Today, we are joined by community justice organizer and Portland activist Andre Miller, discussing the upsurge in gun violence and how we can reimagine community safety.
Thanks for doing this. I just basically want to start off with you introducing yourself and just telling me a little bit about your position.
Yeah, my name is Andre Miller. I'm an activist and advocate in the community. And professionally, I work for Commissioner Joanne Hardesty as a community justice organizer.
Dope. So can you tell me a little bit about how you got involved in social justice?
Social justice kind of runs through my family lineage. My father was a social service worker and did some work with the Black Panthers as well. I became an activist after Mike Brown and Trayvon Martin got murdered. I was kind of just watching how the movement kind of went about and learning from the other leaders that were on the ground, trying to identify my strengths and my weaknesses. So then, when I had time to be able to become a leader myself, I was able to know how I could best support the movement that was actually happening. And so then I became a leader in the Black Lives Matter movement that was in Portland, Oregon after the murder of George Floyd.
Yeah, and then that kind of just ended up proliferating into a career in activism, yeah, in your social justice work, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's kind of crazy to think that we're almost 2 years away from that, right? That beginning.
Right.
This interview is following an alarming K2 article that came out, about a week ago, saying that we hit a grim milestone of 1,000 shootings just this year. I did a little bit of research, and as of a few days ago, it's actually about 948 shootings, not including what's happened this last weekend. But it's still close and it's still grim. And as someone that's from here, both of us, you know, we've seen a lot of changes over the years. And back in 2020, we had 891 shootings. And then pre-pandemic in 2019, we had 388 shootings. It was a drastic jump. And primarily these shootings are responded by the East and North Precinct, according to the Portland government website. So that kind of gives the audience an idea of where these shootings are occurring. So what have you personally witnessed regarding the upsurge in gun violence? And why do you think it's gotten so out of hand?
To be honest, I think that what I've witnessed is that, you know, I work with a lot of other organizations and community organizations around the country. I've been able to also travel with some of my activism work. I've witnessed that this is a national crisis that we're dealing with. It's not just Portland, Oregon. There's Minneapolis that's also dealing with it. Minneapolis actually has less police officers per person on the streets than Portland does. Where Portland, there's always that false narrative that police put out that Portland is the leanest, most police department per 10,000 people or however they count it. Also, what we know is that, you know, Chicago has put in $2 billion into their police department, and they've had almost 700 murders in the last year.
There's some chills.
Yeah, you know, so there's it's a crisis that we're in, and it has been exacerbated by COVID-19. People not being able to pay their rent, people not knowing what their future looks like, not having resources, not having jobs. If you look at the United States compared to other countries, when you have a large wealth disparity gap, there's a larger increase of violence, and the United States actually leads the whole world in that increase in violence because of the large wealth disparity gap. So what we're seeing here in Portland is that we've been gentrified, we've been redlined, we've been underserved. And when I say we, I mean the Black and brown communities have, and these are the ones that are actually suffering from this. We're seeing generational trauma where there have been generations of family members that have been involved in gun violence and it's being passed down to their kids. You know, one thing that we also know is that the more punitive that you are, the more violent of a society that you also create, you know? So a lot of these kids' parents or fathers have been put in jail. So they grow up without father figures and people to be able to look up to. Portland used to have neighborhoods. We no longer have neighborhoods because we've been gentrified out of our neighborhoods. And what that created for us in the early, in the late 80s and early 90s is, when we had an uptick in violence in the late 80s and early 90s, is you would be able to know at least what neighborhood you were in, you know. Since we've been gentrified and redlined out of our neighborhoods and we no longer really have neighborhoods, those people that have been gentrified to the numbers, which is East Portland, Gresham area, what you see is that those people are actually the same people from multiple different neighborhoods are getting put into the same low-income apartment complexes, you know, so they're having a higher percentage chance of having those retaliatory type of shootings because you're seeing each other almost on a daily, if not a, you know, a weekly, if not a daily basis. Portland's also a tight-knit community where, like, Seattle, California, Minneapolis, all the other places that are dealing with high crime rates and gun violence, Portland's so tight-knit that when we actually have like concerts or when we're going to the bars or weed dispensaries, we're going to these different locations, you have a higher chance of seeing somebody that you might have a conflict with just because Portland is so small.
Mm-hmm. You know, I really want to highlight that statistic you shared earlier. It was $2 billion was put into the police, and was that after the Black Lives Matter uprising of 2020?
That's what they currently have. They're trying to do $2.1 billion, but from the meetings that I've been in the elections, trying to elect new elected officials, there's concerns that they put so much money into the police force already and it hasn't done anything. So they're trying to look into more proactive intervention type of approaches.
Right. And what I think is really powerful about that statistic and what you just said now is that a lot of people, a lot of Portlanders that have either been misguided by misinformation or whatever may have you, people and whatever they're feeling in the moment, they're seeing the protests and they're seeing what happened last year and is still happening sometimes. That is not connected to BLM, but people are blaming the protesters and blaming the riots and so on, you know, and I think it's really powerful to like acknowledge that like Chicago still flooded this money into it and still has had a profound number of shootings. Mm-hmm. And now they're realizing that that's just a dead end and they are looking for more proactive resources to put out into the streets, which I'm going to guess is probably something that looks a little like what we have as the Portland Response Team and just different kind of like mental health services.
Yeah, and I think that that's what we're seeing nationally too, is people are trying to identify how they can take calls away from police officers. Mm-hmm. And whether that be dealing with the houseless population, whether that be dealing with mental health crisis, or even putting what we call is violence interrupters on the streets. And violence interrupters are people that may have been incarcerated previously, may have been a part of a gang, but they have that street credibility and that respect on the streets where they can be able to relate with the people that are actually active right now and kind of make that connection with them and try to turn their path around before they get too involved or before there's another retaliatory type of shooting.
And so these violence interrupters, are they working directly with the police or are they working directly under a different program? Is that completely disconnected from the police force, at least in your experience?
I think that it's different city by city, you know, depending on where the program is actually in. Some of the cities like Portland, the violence interrupters are under the Office of Violence Prevention. The Office of Violence Prevention is then under the mayor, you know what I'm saying?
Got it.
It depends and it ranges from city by city. I know Chicago and other places, like I've talked to Cure Violence Global, and they don't deal directly with police officers. So they try to really do the work amongst themselves as violence interrupters and people that actually have lived expertise.
sounds like a really valid and productive alternative to police. From your perspective, how does gun violence affect our Black and Brown Portlanders compared to our white population?
Yeah, I mean, I want to be honest. I think that it affects everybody, right? The people that are most impacted is our most marginalized community members, is our Black and Brown community members. And I think that it affects us mostly because the statistics show that you're poor. We're the largest population, we're the smallest population, but the largest population being murdered, being impacted by gun violence. So I think that, it goes back to making sure that we have the resources available, making sure that we have jobs, making sure that we're being proactive in our approaches and giving the kids the skills and the tools that they need to be able to de-escalate conflict before conflict even happens.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate it. The strategies that you have behind things, you have solutions and problem solving already happening, and there are programs out there. By saying these and sharing these statistics, I think it's really positive and encouraging because people feel really helpless right now and want to know how they can help. So I really appreciate that input. So let's see, what proactive measures are you taking towards keeping the community safe from gun violence?
One thing that I really try to do is, being somebody that's born and raised here in Portland, Oregon, I've been impacted by gun violence. I've experienced gun violence. I've had several friends that's been murdered, been put in jail. I have several cousins that have also been murdered. So I'm impacted by gun violence, right? One thing that I do when I go into meetings talking about gun violence, I tell people my experience. I tell people how I'm impacted by it. So they get that understanding that my approaches are making sure that we're tearing down the systemic barriers that have been put in place that continue to profile us or put us in more danger in the future rather than just trying to actually look at the symptom. I'm trying to teach them to look at the cause of it. So I really look at the root cause of the violence. I really look for upstream type of solutions and proactive measures. One thing that I personally am doing is that I'm trying to get in the schools and curriculum that is able to teach kids like altruism, able to teach kids life sustainability, give them the shame reduction type of programs and conflict resolution type of programs, because we also know that a lot of the violence that actually happens is because people feel disrespected and they don't know how to handle that once they feel disrespected. There's a sense of detachment away from society, and even as men, we have to kind of rethink what is being a man. Change the social norms and the cultural norms of surrounding what a man should be. We're always taught that if we don't respond to a certain thing, that we're a punk, all the other bad terms and terminologies that we are if we don't react to somebody putting us down. So we have to change that mindset. We have to start young. It's not something that we can do right now. We're never going to be able to stop crime right now, because what it has been is this been what they call the structural violence, which is policies that have been put in place for so long that is actually steering the behavioral violence that we're actually seeing right now on the streets. So there's no way to be able to stop violence right now. We have to really use a proactive approach. That means getting them as young as elementary school. I have a 6-year-old that I'm always talking about things that are actually going on in society, things that I'm working on. I'm always getting my older kids involved in what's going on, because I want to know what they want their community to look like. They're going to be the ones raising kids in the near future. So anything that we're implementing, it needs to be their vision, what we actually want to do. So I think what we're seeing too is that is really new is, even though social media isn't new, but there's a lot of stuff that goes on social media that boils off, boils over into the streets.
Mm.
You know, people feel shamed on social media, and instead of knowing how to handle that conflict on social media, which should be the easiest way to handle it rather than handle it in person, right? Because you're not eye to eye, face to face. I mean, there's an audience, there's a crowd that might be seeing it, but you don't know that they're actually seeing it, you know? So we really have to give the kids and the youth the skills and the tools to be able to de-escalate conflict. And that's really what we're talking about when we're talking about like reimagining public safety and what that looks like too, right? We want mental health experts responding to certain type of calls to be able to de-escalate situations rather than police responding to them, you know what I'm saying? We want peer mentors, we want violence interrupters or youth interrupters that can actually go and talk to these kids once they get into those situations after they actually have the skills and the tools from a younger age, giving them the skills and the tools. But once they get to that situation where they are trying to figure out how to implement those skills and those tools to be able to de-escalate a situation, they can have an older mentor then there to help guide them.
Right. And I wonder, I heard a little segment off of an interview recently, and they were talking about social media and how that has does have a link to a lot of the upsurge of school shootings. You know, there's just so much pressure on children right now, and like putting, like implementing this program that's in front of them, that's linked to them all the time, you know, and it's like based on whether you're getting accepted or not by your peers, you know, that's putting a lot of peer pressure on it. So like by having those resources out there and those communications and that dialogue, you know, that's important.
Yeah, and that's another thing important that you touched on too, is like the in-group and the out-group type of things, you know what I'm saying? Like we have to really like really think about our social norms as far as like identifying that, you know, because people start feeling secluded away from society by just the popular versus the not popular type of kids, you know, and how they group themselves together in school. So really retraining the mind, but doing it in a proactive way where we're starting, like I said, with elementary school kids to be able to see 5 or 10 years from now how that is actually impacting them.
Mm-hmm. And that impacts in like social norm circles in the future too, and also especially with COVID right now, as people are choosing the little bubbles and staying within them, you know, and I'm sure that's just dividing more and more.
It's dividing,
you know?
More and more. I mean, we're seeing it even after Trump, you know. I mean, now we have the anti-maskers versus the maskers. We have the anti-vaxxers versus the vaxxers.
Right.
You know? We have police, pro-police versus non-police, you know.
Right.
So it's so much division right now that we really have to start thinking like, how can we stop this division? But also, how can we just change and retrain the mind for the like the thinking of the social norms?
Yep. Man, I got chills. Like, I feel really inspired, and you know, kind of the way you speak about it, it feels like there is a hope for it, because some days do feel a little hopeless.
Yeah, it does. Absolutely. I mean, it's just really important that we're actually, when people are diving into these type of topics, that we're actually educating ourselves about it. You know, like it's so easy to know that you're impacted by something, knowing that there's like gunshots happening almost on a nightly basis right from your window, you know, steps from your window or right in your neighborhood. It's so easy to be like, we need more police or we need to do this, not knowing that adding more police to the streets, you know, profiles and does things like stop and frisk for younger black and brown youth, you know, that then can get them charged with low level type of offenses that they weren't even originally like pulled over for, you know. Police might think that, hey, this person looks like they have a weapon, you know, and
right.
You know, back in the day they had like a gang list, you know, depending on who you hung out with, you would be on that gang list, depending on what you actually wore, how you looked, the area code that you lived in, the block that you lived on, you know what I'm saying, you would be on that gang list. So just knowing it, like, even though we're impacted by these situations, and that's why when I go into meetings, I tell them about my experience and how I'm also impacted by it, how I have friends that have lost their children, you know, just in this last summer to gun violence. But it's important that we actually educate ourselves on the root causes and try to find like proactive and upstream solutions.
Yep. Yep, I love it. Yeah, I mean, everyone thinks that either you have no police or more police, right? Like, because everyone's just a solution, but no one's thinking outside the box, you know, and thinking of alternative solutions and alternative, like, ideas of, like, what community safety really looks like.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that nobody really talks about is, like, clearance rates and what clearance rates are how police officers can actually solve their crimes, their homicides, you know, so it's really like a homicide rate. So when a homicide happens, to get your clearance rate is to solve that actual homicide, right? So you can't increase clearance rates by actually adding more police to the streets, and that's statistically proven. And it's statistically proven that you need to have a relationship with your community that you're actually serving. The police officers need to have a relationship with their community that they're actually serving. But what that also means is that the community needs to trust the police, and that isn't happening right now. So even if you add more detectives or more police to the streets, the clearance rates aren't going to go up because people aren't going to feel comfortable talking to the police and be like, hey, I saw this, I'm a witness to this,
right.
This is what actually happened. The only way that you do that is by the community having trust in the police, but the police haven't been proven to be trustworthy at the moment, and there's no relationship there.
Right, the statistics, a large portion of Portland police don't even live in the city. They
right.
live far. They're not even connected with the community, you know?
Right.
So, like, how are you supposed to build trust and relationships with these people
mm-hmm.
when you're, you know, facing such a, like, very dramatic and stressful circumstance?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do you have anything else you want to talk about before we wrap up this interview?
I mean, I think that it's just important to know that, you know, like I touched on, like, it's a national crisis that we're in right now.
Right.
You know, we also, besides just the pandemic, we lived under 4 years of a president that spoke highly on violence, you know. So people were really uncertain of their future, and even when he was president, you know, that's when the gun purchasing really skyrocketed, you know. So really understanding it, you know, the pandemic that we're in, the last 4 years that we were in, the United States having the largest wealth disparity gap, which it also means that we also have the largest violent crimes in the United States, and really just making sure that we're educating ourselves on the root causes and trying to make sure that whatever we're doing, it doesn't cause more generational harm for future generations.
Dope. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, as always. I'm sure this won't be the last time.
Yeah, most definitely.
Word up.
Thank you for joining us today, and stay tuned for more interviews, podcasts, and short documentaries coming up in the following months. We'll see you soon.